Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. The Washington Post is reporting that President Trump is being investigated for obstruction of justice by Robert Mueller, the special counsel in charge of the Russia investigation. What are the politics behind this latest revelation? Donald Trump is set to announce changes to U.S. policy towards Cuba today in Miami and is expected to reverse some of the gains made in recent years and double down on the traditional U.S. policy of unmitigated aggression against Cuba. The U.S.-led coalition has admitted to the use of white phosphorus in Mosul, with evidence also pointing to its use in Raqqa, Syria. What is white phosphorus, and is this a blatant war crime? But first, we turn to the possibility of Donald Trump being now investigated for obstruction of justice. We are joined from New York by Ray McGovern. He is an activist and a former CIA analyst whose writings can be found at raymcgovern.com. And we're also joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh. He is the editor of thepolemicist.net. Welcome, Ray and Jim.
Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Ray McGovern, the Washington Post has reported, and this was late on Wednesday, that Robert Mueller, the special counsel, former FBI director, now special counsel, is investigating whether Trump is responsible for obstruction of justice. What do you make of this?
Well, this, of course, came up during the most recent hearing. And I remember one senator saying, now, does expressing a hope that someone will do something, does that constitute obstruction of justice? And Comey sort of said, well, you know, I ain't going to do it. Well, no, wait a second. You're a prosecutor. I was a prosecutor, says a senator. Has anyone been convicted or even brought to trial for expressing a hope? And Comey does swallow it, and he says, well, no. Okay. So what this is pretty much what, I hate to agree with Trump because I despise everything he's doing in this country. But when he says this is made up stuff, when he says it's phony, when he says that this is a diversion because the Russian angle won't work anymore because they can't find any evidence after 11 months, count them, 11 months, Comey's been at it. And so they're saying now, well, we'll do obstruction, or how about a monument? Oh, monuments would be good. We had Amy Goodman this morning having John Conyers on. He didn't seem all that awake, but he was given notes to say, no, a monument. We'll get on a monument. And Amy says, what's a monument? And after a while, Conyers was able to explain what it was. Now, if they want to impeach this guy, and I'm very much for impeachment, they ought to impeach him for violating willy-nilly Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, which reserves to the Congress, the representatives of the people, the right to declare, authorize, or make war. Now, wouldn't that be something? Did he do that? Of course he did that with respect to Syria on the 6th of April this year. Now, why don't they do that? Because Congress is accomplice in all this. Congress doesn't want to exert its authority. Congress is just as happy to have the presidents launch these wars, perpetuate these wars, even though it's an abdication of their responsibility under the first article of the Constitution, Section 8. And, you know, this is really lamentable because were they to do that, were they to act in a responsible way for this high crime of starting a war without congressional approval, well, you know, that might create a real nifty precedent for the future, right? Maybe we could bring our troops home from these fools' errands trying to change the Middle East.
James Kavanaugh, I agree with Ray McGovern that obviously the war, the bombing, the 59 cruise missiles against Syria was a violation of U.S. law. It was a violation also of the U.N. Charter. And the U.S. is a signatory to the U.N. Charter, and thus it's the highest law of the land. But of course, chief executives have not been getting congressional approval for wars of aggression for a long time and hasn't sought the congressional approval since World War II. So probably Donald Trump won't be impeached for that. Donald Trump sent a couple more tweets yesterday morning, June 15th. He wrote, and this is after the report in the Washington Post and now picked up by the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, that Mueller is shifting the investigation to obstruction of justice, not necessarily Russia collusion per se. This is what Trump tweeted. They made up a phony collusion with Russia story, found zero proof, so now they go for obstruction of justice on the phony story. Nice. And then a second tweet. You are witnessing the single greatest witch hunt in American political history, led by some very bad and conflicted people. Now, that's a high bar to get the greatest witch hunt in American history, because there have been some pretty big witch hunts. But what do you think about all of this?
Well, I think, you know, yeah, Donald Trump is excessively victimizing himself here. But what is true, I think, is what Ray said also. They haven't been able to find any definitive proof on this Russiagate business. So now what they're doing is kind of what they did to Martha Stewart, which is, okay, we can't get you on the underlying crime, but there is this other thing, which is now the obstruction of justice. And what they're trying to do is, by interviewing these other people, is add to what Trump said about Flynn to Comey, and go to these other people and say, did Trump ask you to stop the investigation? Did he ask you? So they can get a pattern of behavior which might indicate a obstruction of justice. So what's strange is that you'll see the Russiagate thing kind of dissipate in favor of this secondary thing, which is the obstruction of justice on top of it. And they can threaten the other people who might have, at least I saw some of this the other day, that some of these other people, the head of the CIA or the other intelligence officials, might have said something false to the FBI previously, so they threaten them with perjury, try and get them to roll over on Trump. I don't know that any of this is going to work. I don't know if there's any real legal punch behind it, but they are interrupting Trump, and they are putting the pressure on him, and they are sending the message. We're going to get you if you don't be a reliable partner in our foreign policy endeavors. And, you know, so that's really what's going on here. There's another thing which we should be aware of, and because nobody's going to impeach Trump unless the Republicans are behind it. The Republicans aren't going to get behind it unless they themselves are worried, not about Trump's politics, because I don't think he really has any, but about how impulsive and unreliable he is. So that would be a real reason that a lot of people might want to, you know, if he proves himself to be so impulsive and so unreliable, then perhaps they can get some Republicans on board with this. But I don't know where it's going to go. Trump is a victim of his own narcissism here. If he had said nothing, I mean, everybody who watches Law and Order knows, don't talk to the cops. If Trump had said nothing, he would be in no trouble at all about this.
Indeed. And that's the thing, was it seemed to me, Ray, that what really irritated Trump about Comey, in addition to maybe generally disliking him, and the Democrats hated Comey too. They blamed, and Hillary Clinton blamed Comey for her defeat. So I think that Trump thought when he wanted to fire Comey finally, that he would be applauded. I think he was genuinely surprised, meaning that showing how incapable he is as a political leader to not recognize that the Democrats hate Comey when Comey is doing things that the Democrats don't like. But if Comey is doing things against Trump, the Democrats will love Comey. So Trump, I think, just didn't get it. But the thing that irritated Trump was that Comey wouldn't say publicly, he wouldn't leak to the media, that Donald Trump wasn't under a personal investigation for collusion with Russia. That irritated him. And then he thought, well, I can fire Comey and the Democrats will applaud. And then, well, whatever, I'll have my own new FBI director. In other words, he did really kind of create this whole mess for himself based on a miscalculation, a misjudgment. But again, there was absolutely no collusion between Trump or the Trump campaign, or Trump personally, I would say, and Russia, according to Comey's testimony to Trump, which Comey gave to Trump unsolicited in a meeting where Comey actually was the one who cleared the room of all other officials in early January.
Well, Brian, you know, when Trump lashed out at Comey, and was very I think, truthful. He said, I fired him because of this Russia thing. Now, everybody has interpreted that to say, oh, because I wanted to stop the investigation of ties between our campaign and Russia. But it wasn't that. It was the fact that Comey, at that point, had spent 10 intensive months sicking his FBI on each and every person he could find to find evidence of this Russian-Trump collusion. And he came up with zero, zippo, nothing, okay? Nothing that they could adduce as any real proof. And when Trump said, well, it's this Russian thing, it's Russia-Trump. Well, after 10 months, in my view, and this is all, speculation, it's all analysis, in my view, he's fed up. And he said, I'm going to get rid of this guy because he's being insubordinate and he's not really looking into what I need looked into. And that is, how is it the New York Times and the Washington Post gets all these leaks earlier from the Obama administration and now from NSA, CIA, FBI? I think there really is a deep state, says Trump to himself. And I'm going to take him head on. I'm going to fire this guy. And he does. Now, I don't believe that he wasn't prepared to face the consternation and the outcry that caused. He just wanted to do it and see what happened. Now, what happened? Well, the next thing, Comey, a very, very accomplished bureaucrat, he leaks to the New York Times this memo that supposedly he wrote, where Trump is telling him to, expressing the hope, let's be accurate here, expressing the hope that he would let go this this Flynn investigation because he's a good guy, he's quit, and there's nothing there. Well, what happens? Comey leaks this to the New York Times, right? And by his own admission, he says, my purpose in leaking it to the New York Times was to get a special prosecutor appointed. Whoa, what happens? Oh, man, the deep state is really effective. A day or two later, what happens? A special prosecutor gets put. And who is it? It's Comey's old pal. His old pal, Robert Mueller, the former FBI director. Now, these two guys, as Colleen Rowley, who worked for them, pointed out in a memorandum, which she couldn't get published in the New York Times for the first time. In other words, Colleen Rowley speaks with such authenticity and authority that the Times has always taken her op-eds or her memos, this time not. Why? Because she points out that these guys are a bunch of crooks, that they approved torture, that they approved illegal surveillance, that they helped make the case for the war against Iraq. These guys are really bad guys, and on that I have to agree again with Trump saying, what did he say? That they're very bad and conflicted. And of course they are conflicted. Who would have possessed the Deputy Attorney General to appoint Comey's best friend, Mueller, to investigate all this stuff? So this is what happened. The other thing, of course, the ancillary factor here, is that by getting the special prosecutor named and giving him this very damaging, so to speak, a memo of conversation between Mueller and the president, it's kept out of congressional hands. It's kept out of news hands. It's given to his best friend, Bob Mueller, okay? And so that's a very artful and successful accomplishment. The only question I have is how this fellow who's, what's his name, Rosenstein or something? Deputy Attorney General. What kind of hold? In other words, here's Comer going to this guy and saying, look, I'd like you to appoint Bob Mueller. Now, in the old days with J. Edgar Hoover, he'd come with a little folder and say, and by the way, we have two folders here, one on you and one on Mueller. And so it'd really be a good idea if you did what I said. Now, I don't know if that's what happened here, but that has happened traditionally in the past.
Because we only have a very limited amount of time, I want to bring Jim Kavanaugh back. The Washington Post ran a story the day after Comey was fired I'm going to paraphrase it. It said something like this: FBI asked for more resources for the Russia probe, making it seem like Trump had fired Comey because he had wanted more resources for the Russian investigation. That was the headline. That's what informed public opinion about why Comey was fired. But then that too later turned out to be untrue. In other words, even Comey and Rosenstein and the other officials in the Justice Department and the FBI said, no, that's not how it works. That's not what happened. We have 2.5 minutes left. Go ahead.
All right. Yeah, I was going to say, in a larger picture, again, this points out is the pretextualness of all this. Okay, if anybody are interested about the integrity of American elections or who's interfering in American elections, they would start out with the broken American electoral system and the way it's designed to enable fraud by electronic means. And that's what, in fact, the Intercept article about the NSA memo ended up with. We have problems with the electoral system. They were talking about the electoral polls, the poll books, which are electronically kept now, are dangerous. If anybody are interested in foreign interference with elections, they'd start out with Israel and with a country which writes the platforms for the Democratic Party, whose prime minister comes and lectures the Congress, and who vets and has to approve political candidates down to the level of state assembly. So nobody's really interested in that. Okay? And this is a pretext for what we all know is that they're afraid that Trump is not a reliable asset in the aggression they want to put forward against Russia, and they are putting forward against Russia and other places too. And, of course, Trump isn't a reliable candidate. I mean, but I don't think they have anything really to fear about that. He's not going to be a peacenik. He's attacked Syria, you know. So, but they want someone who's more reliable than that, and all of this goes to that issue. And, you know, we're watching. What's amazing to me is that so many progressives get on board with this and are on this Russiagate thing, and Trump is a treason and he's a spy. I mean, the Russians are not so stupid as to hire Donald Trump as a spy. It's just so silly. But the seriousness of what's behind it is something else. I mean, and there are good reasons from our point of view to get rid of Trump and impeach Trump, but that's not why the Republicans and Democrats are going to do it. There may be good reasons even that they would do it, which is that he's very unreliable and impulsive and dangerous in that sense, but they can't say that. They can never say what they're actually doing. They have to put forward something else that reinforces another narrative, and the big danger here for the Republicans, good as far as I'm concerned, is that's going to break up the Republican Party. If Republicans vote to impeach Trump, Trump voters are going to say, you see, the establishment came in and with a lot of bull and with reasons that are going to be bull, they did away with the person that we voted for. And that's going to be a very dangerous thing. I mean, I welcome it in a sense because I'm not in a sense. I welcome what it's going to do to the Republican Party, but
yeah, it's not certainly. I mean, if Trump is driven out for this reason, I mean, there are a million reasons, as we've said, to get rid of Donald Trump. The attacks on immigrants, the attack on Medicaid, the attack on people's health care, the rising racism, misogyny. But the Democrats are perfectly happy to deal with Trump and fight against Trump on a purely right-wing basis and a made-up basis, I would say. Anyway, we are completely out of time. We've been joined by Ray McGovern. He's an activist and former CIA analyst, whose writings can be found at raymcgovern.com. And we've also been joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh, editor of thepolemicist.net. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Donald Trump is set to announce changes to U.S. policy towards Cuba today in Miami and is expected to reverse the gains made in recent years and double down on a traditional U.S. policy of unmitigated hostility towards Cuba. We are joined from Montreal by Arnold August. He is a lecturer, journalist, and author of the new book, Cuba-U.S. Relations, Obama and Beyond. Welcome back, Arnold.
Thank you once again for having me.
Thank you. Well, you wrote your book, Obama and Beyond. We're certainly in the beyond phase. Donald Trump is now the president. He's in Miami today. We'll find out later today what exactly he intends to say. But I want to go back to a short clip from a speech of Donald Trump that he made during the Republican primary debate last year. It's about the thaw in U.S.-Cuba relations under Obama. Here's Donald Trump.
All of the concessions that Barack Obama has granted the Castro regime were done through executive order, which means the next president can reverse them. And that I will do unless the Castro regime meets our demands.
That he will do. Will he reverse the executive order? What do you expect?
I expect that today he will definitely not reverse the main executive order with regards to diplomatic relations. In other words, I think that despite the rhetoric for which some of the pro-anti-Castro Miami attendees and today's activity may be happy with that, but they are definitely going to be disappointed that Trump is not announcing an end to diplomatic relations with Cuba. In fact, I will say that today they will be suffering a defeat, and in some way it's a victory for Cuba, because the worst case scenario, as you know, Brian, would be that Trump would completely end diplomatic relations with Cuba. Now, the main feature of the Obama policy is that he decided to change the tactics only and not the goal. The tactics being, instead of having an aggressive attitude towards Cuba and the Cuban government, they would now adopt a more soft attitude towards Cuba by opening diplomatic relations, which is a very good thing. Now, I think, and this is what I, you know, sort of hinted at in my book, I actually made it very clear that Trump will only be changing his tactics within the tactics of the Obama administration. That is, making a few cosmetic changes, some of them may be harsh, but still within the tactic of Obama, of seeking to change tactics in order to reach the ultimate objective, which is to subvert the Cuban Revolution and Cuban sovereignty.
Well, I want to ask you then whether there seems to be, or in your opinion, is a contradiction or a contradiction of different forces, different political forces within the Trump administration, within the Trump cabinet about Cuba, because Trump has gone out of his way to go to Miami to make this speech today. It will be delivered at the Manuel Artime Theater in Little Havana, named after the leader of the Bay of Pigs invasion of 1961. That's when the U.S.-led mercenary forces invaded Cuba with the hope of overthrowing the Cuban government. That failed. But why pick the theater there? Why pick the legacy of the Bay of Pigs invasion? Why pick Miami if all he's doing is cosmetic tweaks?
I think that the main feature by him going there today, and that specific theater that you mentioned, is to find appropriate menu for his rhetoric with regards to Cuba. That is, there's no democratic rights, there's political prisoners, there's repression, etc., etc., which, by the way, is similar to what Obama said, but with his more Ivy League tone when he was president. So by this, he will, of course, you know, give some enthusiasm, get some enthusiasm from the people attending his show. At the same time, he will make sure that there is no indication that he attempts to end diplomatic relations with Havana. This, of course, will probably disappoint the attendees today. However, the vast majority of Cuban Americans, all polls have shown this, coming from different horizons of the political spectrum, most Cuban Americans support the ending of the blockade. He will be speaking to a small minority within the Cuban American community who are, in fact, have been profiting from the reversal, Obama's policy for increased trade and travel to Cuba. So they're going to find themselves in a difficult situation today, and I think it'll be a defeat for them, even though they may not they may admit it or not. And I think that if we go beyond Miami a bit, go to a state of such as Texas, which is Republican, as you know. They issued a statement. There's a coalition of government and business people in that important state that issued a statement a few weeks ago, a couple of months ago, saying that an open letter to Trump saying, listen, you said you campaigned on Make America Great Again. Well, if you want to make America great again in Texas, you cannot cut off our economic and commercial ties with Cuba, which are already developing, because this is providing many jobs and other opportunities for people in Texas. And the governor of Texas, who is a Republican, visited Cuba several months ago with a very clear message that we want to increase trade with Cuba. Like Texas, the ports of Texas, as you know, those ports are very close to Havana. It's a natural, important relationship between Texas and Cuba.
Arnold, the Washington Post earlier this week ran an article. I want to read a short excerpt to you from it. It's along the lines of what you're talking about. Farm state Republicans have appealed to Trump to help them expand Cuban markets rather than to close them. A newly introduced Senate bill to lift remaining travel restrictions has attracted 54 co-sponsors, including 10 Republicans. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Manufacturers have called for expanding relations with the island. Major travel and agricultural companies and associations have publicly warned that a reversal would cost American jobs. Now, that's from the Washington Post earlier this week, all along the lines of what you're talking about. So what you're anticipating then is harsh anti-communist, anti-Castro, anti-Cuban revolution rhetoric. But in terms of both the diplomatic status, that is the beginning of normalization, and certainly the opening of the embassies by both countries, one in Havana, one in Washington, D.C., in other words, the beginning of diplomatic ties, you don't believe there's going to be a reversal on either front, either the diplomatic front or in terms of economic policy?
Well, there's two different things. Diplomatic relations is very simple. Either you have diplomatic relations and embassies in respective capitals, or you do not. Right now, the two countries do as a result of the Obama policy. Now, I believe that Trump will not reverse the diplomatic relationship. He may introduce through executive action, maybe not even today, but later on, that may impose some restrictions on trade and travel. We'll have to wait to see that tomorrow. But even if he does that, even if he does introduce some trade and travel restrictions, the game is not over, because after today, what's going to happen? The game does not finish today. If he announces these things, I've been watching, for example, very closely, you mentioned several statements that came out earlier this week with regards to Trump's policy, trying to influence in a positive way. Since then, I mean, you know, the last few days, this has increased substantially with other important sections of the American population, such the Cuban educational community, a variety of different sections of Cuban society taking a very strong stand. We not only do not want a rollback, but we want an end to trade and travel restrictions altogether. So I think, irrespective of what he says today, if there are any restrictions on trade and travel, this, you know, struggle is going to go on after today, because those who are taking a stand now, the ones you mentioned and the more recent ones, they're not going to lie over backward today, and I think they will increase their lobbying effort before Trump actually introduces executive actions. I think that this is going to be an ongoing story, and I think that Trump is, you know, I think, and in one word, based on what Tillerson said yesterday and the way things are going, Trump, on one of the few issues in international domestic policy, Trump actually is taking a retreat, doing a small retreat by blocking off any possibility of breaking diplomatic relationship with the two countries, which is really the policy that draws a line between going forward and going backward. So this is going to carry on for weeks and months.
Secretary of State Tillerson, as you mentioned, told Congress on Tuesday, quote, "We are supportive of continued economic development as long as it's done in full compliance with our existing statutes, not to provide financial support to the regime. The general approach is to allow as much of this continued commercial and engagement activity to go on as possible, because we do see the sunny side of benefits to the Cuban people. Rex Tillerson, that's what he mainly cares about, Arnold, is the Cuban people. That aside, it certainly indicates that at least Tillerson represents those forces within the Trump government that don't want to roll back and, in fact, perhaps expand economic ties between U.S. and Cuba. We only have a few minutes left, but I want to help audience understand what the basic reason is for the animus, the animosity, the adversarial and antagonistic nature of U.S.-Cuban relations since 1959. The United States invaded Cuba 1898, presumably to support Cuban independence from Spain. In other words, to be part of the anti-colonial liberation of Cuba, but then took over Cuba and treated Cuba, made Cuba into a neo-colony. Certainly, the U.S. supported the Batista dictatorship during those terrible years of the 1950s. And then Fidel Castro and the July 26th movement had a revolution, an armed struggle. Batista fled, and his supporters ultimately fled to Miami. And then Cuba became independent, genuinely independent, and became an inspiration for Latin America. But then it also announced in 1961 that it was, in fact, a socialist revolution. It wasn't just an anti-colonial revolution, but it was a socialist project. And Cuba reorganized its economy and really, at that time, broke free of the United States. What you were saying in the beginning is the U.S. has realized its policies of extreme animosity has failed, but the U.S. government still hopes to overthrow the Cuban socialist project. Help the audience understand why. Why is that a big deal? Cuba's not a big country. It's not threatening the United States. It doesn't constitute a military threat. Why is the United States so hostile to Cuba?
You're right. Cuba is not such a big country geographically, but I think history has shown over the decades that Cuba's voice, Cuba punches above its weight with regards to political, cultural influences, an example. And I think this is the main problem Obama had with Cuba and now President Trump, that what they are concerned about Cuba is not, you know, supposedly human rights or prisoners or oppression, etc. What they are concerned about, that Cuba persists after all these decades and problems and pressures of the blockade to maintain, even if there are many problems, maintain basically a socialist system and, above all, their independence and sovereignty vis-a-vis the United States. The United States does not like it. If it was a question of a democracy, human rights, etc., how come the United States has such close ties with Saudi Arabia, who is notorious as an example of violating human rights and having, you know, prisoners, executing prisoners, things like that, but they have very good relations with the United Arab Republic. The issue really is Cuba's sovereignty and socialism. This is what they do not like. And we have to say that, we're saying that, you know, we are in the beyond time with regards to Obama. Yes and no, we are beyond Obama, and now we're into Trump. But the basic, if you read the statements very carefully, the basic outlook of United States towards Cuba is the same, irrespective of the president. That is, like Obama never said that he wants to help the Cuban government. And all the speeches that I read, and I read them all, he always says, what we are doing is to help the Cuban people, which is a euphemism to try to win over, seduce the Cuban people over to the side of the U.S. model of society. Now, Trump said the same thing, but in a much more harsh, crude way, as only he can do. And he said, no, we don't want to help the Cuban people. And he's talking about the Cuban army and the Cuban government and the Cuban army. But it's basically the same outlook that is really at the heart of U.S. imperialist policy towards Cuba. So I think that this is the main reason they want to undermine the Cuban Revolution, whether it was Obama before or Trump now, with his own Trump Tower trademark on the relationship between U.S. and Cuba.
Okay, we're out of time. We've been joined from Montreal by Arnold August. He is a lecturer, journalist, and author of the new book, Cuba, U.S. Relations, Obama, and Beyond. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The U.S.-led coalition in Iraq has admitted to the use of white phosphorus in Mosul, with evidence also pointing to its use in Raqqa, Syria. What is white phosphorus, and is this, in fact, a blatant war crime? We are joined from Madrid by Alberto Garcia Watson. He is a former senior Middle East correspondent for Hispan TV. Welcome back, Alberto.
Thanks for having me.
Alberto, I want to play a short clip from RT television that kind of goes over the basics of what white phosphorus is. Let's listen to the clip, and then I want to ask you a few questions.
To give you an idea of what white phosphorus is, it is an offensive weapon that's self-igniting. It burns quickly and produces an immediate smoke screen. Well, its use is banned in densely populated civilian areas by the Geneva Conventions. The reason why is because the impact is notably catastrophic to the human body. The chemical reportedly causes skin to melt away from the bone.
Causes the skin to melt away from the bone. Wow. The U.S.-led coalition, Alberto, in Iraq admitted this week that it's using white phosphorus in Mosul. That's the second biggest city in Iraq. New Zealand General Hugh Magazian told National Public Radio, quote, "We have utilized white phosphorus to screen areas within West Mosul to get civilians out safely." In other words, the U.S. is using white phosphorus for humanitarian purposes.
Well, that's absolutely absurd and ridiculous. The white phosphorus actually was meant for the usage against armies, against military targets. But unfortunately, in the past years, we've seen how certain armies, and especially the American army, has used it in heavily dense population areas. And other nations, allies of the United States, have been using them. Saudi Arabia has used them in Yemen. Actually, they got them from the United States. And as very well was explained before, it causes tremendous pains and tremendous wounds. I happened to be in the Gaza Strip in 2012 when one of the many Israeli operations happened against the Gaza Strip. And I happened to see some terrible wounds that had happened. I saw it actually afterwards. I saw it a year later when I returned back to the Gaza Strip, and I went to the Shifa Hospital, the main hospital in the city, and I saw how it was still dealing with the wounds. Very often they even had to amputate arms and legs, and actually it's a kind of wound that goes all the way down to the bone. It melts the flesh, the skin, and even the bone, and it produces also a very toxic gas that can be lethal. A lot of children that were not aware of this kind of weapon even played with stones and parts of this explosive, not knowing what the consequences were, and hundreds of especially youngsters suffer from this terrible weapon. It's an incendiary type of weapon that it can burn for days and days. It's incredible. It was also used in Israeli aggression in Lebanon in 2006, even though the Israeli army denied its usage, but it was used there. It was used in the first and the second battles in Fallujah in 2004. And I remember it was in April 2004, the first battle, and it was in, I think, November, the second battle. Usually the consequences is the death of enormous amounts of civilians and terrible wounds, as I said, that can run for months, if not years, to heal. So when they talk about humanitarian use of this weapon, let me tell you, this is absolutely absurd, and it's cynical to use this narrative, because it's very difficult to point at the target with this kind of weapons that explodes into hundreds, if not thousands, of little projectiles. So it's actually ridiculous to call it a humanitarian purpose of its use, because it's actually civilians, the biggest amount of casualties that suffer the consequences of this explosive.
The United States used a white phosphorus in Vietnam. If you go back, if the audience goes back and, you know, Googles or goes to some search engine and looks for white phosphorus Vietnam, you'll see huge amounts of white phosphorus being used. The U.S. also, you know, it also dropped so much napalm on the people in Korea and in Vietnam. Gosh, I mean, these are obviously anti-personnel weapons. These weapons are inherently like a crime against humanity, as defined by international law. Why are they tolerated? Why are they not banned?
Unfortunately, most of these weapons, you know that the arms and the weapons industry is the number one industry in the world. So if they will start banning this kind of weapons, the industry will fall apart. So they have to keep the lobbies running in the Senate and the Congress, and not just in the United States, but all around the world, especially with the allies of the United States, who are the best clients of this kind of weapons. As everybody will say, they were using in Vietnam, especially in 1966, is where the biggest amount of weapons related to the white phosphorus was used together with napalm and orange agent. And it was also used in Korea, as far as I remember. And even in the Falkland Islands war between Britain and Argentina, phosphorus grenades were used by the British Army against the Argentinian targets. So it's when is it going to be banned? I mean, when are the nuclear weapons going to be banned? I mean, those are the real bad ones. But it seems like this is more than looking forward to finish the other army. Is a way to provoke a deterrence that will make some other armies around the world buy the weapon. We've seen how in all these decades this weapon has been used. We've seen how many armies have denied the usage, or they have used the excuse justifying the fact that it was, like in this case, used for humanitarian purposes, or the Israelis saying that they had never used it against civilian targets. The British even used it in Iraq in 1920 against the Kurdish militia. And there will be a continuing in the uses of this, because it will never be admitted that it was focused or targeted against civilians. This is collateral damage, as the Americans call it. And therefore, hundreds, if not thousands, of civilians will be targeted by this kind of weapons. We saw it in Iraq already, I mean, since the 2003 American invasion of Iraq. We already have over a million dead in that country, provoked by an unjustified war based on lies.
And the lies were that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. I mean, this is a weapon of mass destruction. I mean, maybe it's not massive, each armament, each usage, but it can't discern, it cannot possibly discern between a civilian and an enemy combatant. I mean, there's just no possible way. The Amnesty International says the substance causes, quote, horrific injuries burning deep into the muscle and the bone. And then there have been reports now that the U.S. coalition is using this weapon in the battle for Raqqa. I mean, you're talking about the liberation of Raqqa from ISIS, but if you're using white phosphorus that does not discern between soldier or civilian, and even if it didn't, I mean, the use of the weapon under these circumstances seems to me to be a weapon of mass destruction, or along the lines of what chemical weapons do or biological weapons do. In other words, the weapon categories we call weapons of mass destruction. The Amnesty documented the use of white phosphorus, Amnesty International, in the east of Mosul in 2016. At that time, it said the use of the substance in the vicinity of population centers. And again, for our audience, Mosul is huge. It's a big city. Even with a lot of people having already fled, it's a big city. Constitutes, according to Amnesty, an indiscriminate attack and can be a war crime. Well, it is a war crime if it's indiscriminate. Now, U.S. Army Colonel Ryan Dillon said, Alberto, that the U.S. military is using it, or does use it, while not admitting its use in Iraq or Syria. In other words, they won't own up to that. But he says when the U.S. does do it somewhere, not there necessarily, it does so, quote, in accordance with the law of armed conflict, and that white phosphorus rounds are used for screening, obscuring, and marking in a way that fully considers the possible incidental effects on civilians and civilian structures. Wow. I mean, they're just doubling down on this.
Yeah, but this, we hear the same narrative when Israel attacks the Gaza Strip. The Gaza Strip is populated by over 2 million people in 40 square kilometers. Any target in the Gaza Strip will represent with this kind of weapons, the destruction and the killing of dozens, if not hundreds, of civilians in just one attack. So when they come up with the story that this is Syrigen's work, the way that they target the Hamas terrorists, as they call them, or here the insurgents in Mosul or in Raqqa, it's absolutely absurd, because we're talking about very heavily populated areas. We're talking about in Mosul, it's the second biggest city in Iraq. It's hundreds of thousands of people besieged. And then we have Raqqa, it's also a big city. And of course, the Gaza Strip. We're not talking about some area in the outskirts of Palmyra. We're talking about heavily density populated areas. So it's totally absurd. It's like when the attacks took place in Vietnam. And in Vietnam, the purpose was to basically flatten the jungle, because it's where the Ho Chi Minh Trail crossed from northern Vietnam into southern Vietnam through Laos and Cambodia and all that jungle area. And yes, they, as far as they say, they had to destroy the jungle to be able to get to this communist terrorist of the Viet Minh and the Viet Cong. However, most of the victims, the casualties that are suffering these attacks, are civilians today still in Vietnam. People are being born with defects and retardation. And it's absolutely incredible. And it's not even one single penny is being paid as a compensation to these victims. So if it happened in Vietnam and it happened in Korea, it has happened in Iraq in 2004. It's happening now in Syria, and it's happening back again in Mosul. It's when we hear the narrative that it cannot be, we are just focusing on insurgent targets, or we are just focusing on forces and terrorists like in the Gaza Strip. However, it seems that the United Nations has a great difficulty condemning when it takes place, when these attacks and these crimes against humanity has as protagonists the United States and Israel. When these two countries are involved in war crimes, the United Nations is extremely careful in condemning this, specifically these two countries. So it's, we would always hear this. But unfortunately, the United States hasn't been invited into Iraq or in Syria. It continues. I mean, the latest that we've heard, well, according to the Russian intelligence, is that the U.S. has deployed an artillery rocket system. It's called the HIMARS, or HIMARS. It's an M142 type of rocket that is supposedly is very, very, very strong type of rocket, very heavily artillery, in the south of Syria. And the Russians are telling already the Syrians that most probably this has been brought from Jordan. No, probably the purpose is actually to attack and to focus on the Syrian forces. The United States has a war not against terrorism in Syria or in Iraq. In Syria, it keeps the same agenda, the same regime change agenda that came from the Obama era, and they just want to get rid of al-Assad at whatever cost. They're playing this puppet show up in Raqqa like they've been playing some other points in this Arab nation. However, their interest is not to finish with the terrorists that they've been financing already since 2011. Actually, the purpose is to have al-Assad fleeing the country or getting killed, just like it happened with Gaddafi. Like it happened with Saddam Hussein, is trying to get rid of leaders that are uncomfortable for the United States Department. And there again, we have this war. They are uninvited. They've been accused by the Syrian government of being uninvited and provoking enormous amounts of civilian casualties. However, the United States will continue, because nobody can stop the United States, nor the United Nations, neither any other organism in the world. And unfortunately, this business of the weapons, United States, unfortunately, is the number one provider of weapons of mass destruction all around the world. And we have countries like Saudi Arabia buying enormous amounts of weapons, as we saw just a couple of weeks ago with a visit of Trump to Saudi Arabia and to Israel too. These two countries who are hostile to the rest of the countries in the Middle East are getting such an enormous amount of weapons and loans of money like Israel that is putting really in danger the Middle East. At this point, the United States has become the worst enemy of the Middle East and the worst enemy of peace.
We're talking with Alberto Garcia Watson from Madrid. Alberto, the United States used white phosphorus in 2004 in the battle for Fallujah. They used it in Afghanistan in 2009. They use it now in order to justify, or to they're justifying it by the war against ISIS, or in 2004, the war against Al-Qaeda or and its incipient form. But these organizations did not exist in Iraq or in Syria until the United States went to war in Iraq in 2003. Now, the United States also used depleted uranium in Iraq. I was in Iraq in 1998, 1999. I was back in 2000 and 2002 recording both the humanitarian impact of economic sanctions and then the relentless everyday bombing by the United States. But what I was seeing through the late 90s and early 2000s as I went to hospitals in Basra and all over the country, including Mosul, was large numbers of children born with terrible, terrible birth defects, anomalies that had not existed in those areas. And the doctors at that time thought it was because the U.S. just dumped so much depleted uranium, a weapon that the U.S. again says, oh, it was used for, it's not going to hurt people. But the doctors there were convinced that this was having an enormous medical impact. It seems as if these doctors and these patients and these communities just never have a voice. We have 1 minute left.
Well, that's absolutely right. And I haven't been to Iraq. I was about to cover the elections in 2014, but at the end, I didn't get the visa on time to get there. But yes, I've heard through agencies and through reporters like you about this usage. But I know because I've been to the main military hospital in Damascus. I visited a lot of patients. We were brought there. And I visited patients also, as I said, in the Shifa Hospital in the Gaza Strip. And this kind of weapons are used constantly, and it provokes, as you very well said, I mean, it provokes the birth of children with all the sorts of defects and malformations. And it goes in time for, I mean, uranium. You can have this consequences running for probably decades.
Oh, thousands of years. In fact, Alberto, we're out of time. We've been joined from Madrid by Alberto Garcia Watson. He's a journalist, formerly the senior Middle East correspondent for Hispan TV. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.